Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave.
And today we have Dr. Susan LeClaire joining us to talk about patient advocacy because as laboratorians, we can also advocate for our patients. So, Dr. LeClaire, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, can you tell us a little bit about some of the different patient advocacy roles that you have played throughout your career?
Okay. The short answer is I have never once shut my mouth. The corollary to that is I have never once been fired or reprimanded. I think in many times people are afraid of a consequence that does not exist. So, what have I done? There was a time, there probably still is a time when you have a hematology result, an increased RDW with a screwy hematocrit, because that's what happens to the instrument. And you need to explain, somebody needs to know that that hematocrit is no longer a valid assessment, that the hemoglobin should be done, or at least an asterisk put next to the hematocrit. Well, you're the only person probably on the planet or in that hospital that knows that, because these are factoids. 90% of medical schools in the United States do not have even an elective in laboratory medicine. And of the remaining ones that do, it's an elective. You don't have to take it. So that means that the person who is standing in front of you in that white coat, claiming to know all, did what my cardiologist told me one day. Well, you just kind of pick up the lab in the third and fourth year of medical school. Okay, so you're starting with a person who thinks they know something that they absolutely do not know. You can let that person rely on what they picked up in the back of the school bus when they were in seventh grade, or you can talk to them and explain this. Whether you do this in a formal setting like rounds, like you could have lab rounds once a month to talk about some case that you know has information to it, or if you're in a teaching hospital, you can semi-require, put yourself into the schedule of orientation for the first year students so that they get a sense of what you do at my place. At least that's something. You could advocate for, and that any hematology resident or fellow be required to spend X number of days, weeks, months, years in the laboratory. And I don't mean sitting there and reading a paper. I mean answering the phone. These last 2 years have taught us that answering the phone is not one of the most pleasant jobs in the laboratory. Well, maybe we should teach them what they sound like. Have them answer the phone. Have them do, you all train CLSs and CLTs. Have them do something like access the samples, prep them for access the specimens, prep them for sampling. Do the stuff that you all do so that they figure out, oh, that just takes a long time. Oh, that to do this stat means that we have to disrupt this entire workflow. Oh, so repeat retics every 8 hours is really not necessary. We've all been there. We all know those things happen. So come on, let's get out there on a more formalized basis, and particularly for hematology fellows. The fact that these people can go through a fellowship, an intensive hematology approach, and never once be in the lab. or spend any significant time in the lab is ludicrous. An example, and I am the world's most horrible example of everything. So some months ago, when I wasn't doing anything special, except I was supposed to be going on a vacation, I ended up having emergency open heart surgery. And for anyone who knows me, this is not a surprise. Apparently, I was not well behaved in the operating room. There was hemorrhaging that wouldn't stop. There was a lot of issues. Due to the need for keep preventing circulatory collapse, it's a lot of fluid. I came out of there not 50 pounds heavier than when I went in. They're taking blood tests and they're freaking out because my platelet count is 19. Well, my plasma volume's been increased by 50 liters of fluid. Everybody listening to this is going, yeah, so? And I'm telling you that the two hematology MDs were convinced I had heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. And were shocked out of their minds when as the liquid volume was being decreased, all of a sudden, because they were giving me platelets, you know, by the bucket, all of a sudden, this is 1960, 82, 680. Mm. Did we give, this is an actual question, did we give her ET? First of all, you don't give somebody ET. They work hard to get it on their own. And no, I did not have essential thrombocythemia. I did have, I think, medically induced thrombocythemia for a while. So then all of a sudden it was, oh, stop all of those. We're back to looking at, well, maybe we should do a bone marrow. Yeah, fortunately, my husband said, I believe she said she would die with her bone marrow virginal and intact. So the answer was no. Grumble, grumble, grumble. And then they finally said to him, you know, we should have asked her. She probably knows the answer. Of course, I'm unconscious with an induced coma by this time. When I woke up, and I do remember this. I don't remember what day. It could have been midnight. Who knew? But I remember waking up and having Jim say to me, da 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 da, they said you would know the answer. And I said, delusional effect. I'm like, hello? Anybody listening over there? Now, did I need extra platelets? Probably. Was I in heparin-induced thrombocytopenia? No. Did I have essential thrombocythemia at the end? No.
I mean, a 600 platelet, especially coming out of a traumatic surgery, to jump to a myeloproliferative, like, you know.
Coming out of surgery, before surgery, I had like a 13 white count because, you know, this little bit of nerves, just teeny bit of nerves. I came out with a 23. Damn, coming out of surgery, that makes sense.
Yep.
They decide for various reasons, I have to be on an adrenaline, an epinephrine drip. What happens to your white cell count when you have a burst of epinephrine? It doubles because your marginating pool comes off. I was on a 36-hour epinephrine drip, so it was consistent. I topped out at, I don't know, 38,000, because I'm betting I had no storage cells in the bone marrow left. That was when they decided, oh, she must have a fungal disease. She must have a bacterial disease. And they wanted to put me on broad spectrum antibiotics and an antifungal. And then they were going to look at maybe viral disorders, because I didn't have a lymphocyte to be seen. So.
But it's because of the volume of granulocytes they induced, right? It's like, it's too much medicine, it sounds like, right? I mean,
yes, but it reduces itself to, they don't know how to understand the CBC.
Yeah. And they're reacting
to a number without understanding, just like any differential or anything else for that matter in life. If you understand the process, the physiology, if you will, of a situation. The changes over time then make sense. But if the only thing that you know is a statistical point here and a statistical point here, and with no connection in between, you can make up whatever relationship you want. Mm. Whose fault is this? Mm. Well, I would argue that part of it, not all of it, certainly, but part of it belongs to maybe the micro lab who all of a sudden has got, you know, viral and fungal and bacterial cultures from somebody who's been in the hospital already 8 days. You might want to check on the person's chart and find out what's going on. And then maybe say, communicate with him so that they know that this is probably because of these increased white cells. And maybe we all should just have a chat, you know, so that you don't have nystatin and you don't have, I've forgotten what the other one was, that they wanted to give me at the time, because I never had an infection. In that sense, the K was great. Hmm. So there's a lack of, it's a huge lack of communication between the two, the physicians and the laboratory, and just like Washington, somebody's got to talk to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And if this side won't talk, this side, the laboratory, has to go meet them, mm. say something. One of the other things that I was telling Melissa, during this time, they had, for some reason, meticulous glucose control. So picture it. You're lying flat. A nurse comes in. You put your hand up. My hands are ice cold. She sticks my finger, milks it up to get something. And then based on that glucose level that she got, gives me insulin. They started insulin whenever the POCT glucose was greater than 100. So they were using the whole blood glucose reference level, and they were applying it to the POCT method. Now, finger sticks generally can be about 20% higher than whole blood. Finger sticks that are milked have more contamination, and that's higher still. Mm. So they were hitting me with, oh my God, you have 100 glucose, and giving me insulin, I was probably, what'd you guess, hypoglycemic for a while. Perhaps it is the laboratory's responsibility to speak to whomever is doing POCTs in whatever, maybe you can do it unit by unit, you know, because it might be different unit by unit, and say to them, that's not the way things work. You can't use this result with this reference range. You have to understand that process. So that's A. A very long time ago, I had one of your classes. I can say it that way, not yours, so you can feel good about this. I had one of the more intellectually strong classes, like all freaking A's and B's, that I think I ever had in my life. They were the nastiest, meanest, most uncharitable, self-absorbed group of people I've ever met in my life. Those exercises that I used where there was teamwork required caused people to leave in tears, slam out of the door because they couldn't do it. Well, during that time, the internet was very, very new. So this is, you know, before God. And I went on it to see if I could find stories or something that would help them understand that the stuff in the tube belong to somebody, and that maybe that might click. And I came upon a group that at the time was called Heme Onc, and it was for anybody who had hematology diseases and that were on oncology. And they were basically all patients. They were basically trying to live. You know, one of them would say, I don't know, I love peanut butter. Can I eat peanut butter? Is there anybody here who, you know, and somebody else would say, no, don't do that, because this has happened. And there was a story about this woman whose child had been finished his induction for ALL. And the physician said, well, all we need is a calcium and we'll send him home. And he stayed overnight. And the mother was that word about this whole thing. And she's screaming on the net saying, you know, we brought him to the best hospital to get the best physician, you know, and we worked and worked with the nurses for all this time, and to have some stupid person in the laboratory screw this up so that he had to stay overnight and miss his brother's birthday party. She was just, well, that was a very big red button for me. And I pushed. And I wrote back. Do you know if he wrote it down as an order? Do you know if the order was transcribed? Do you know if it was collected and by whom? Do you know if it was collected correctly and sent correctly down to the laboratory? Do you know if it was labeled? You know, and I went through all of that. And I've been with this group since mid-1990s. And all of a sudden, I got on five others. Because the ALL split off and the CLL split off and the myeloproliferative split off. And so all of a sudden, when I was teaching you guys, I was busy, you know, doing this other stuff. And I was explaining to them the basics of hematology. What's a hematocrit? What's a white cell count? What's a platelet count? The myeloproliferatives have a meeting every other year in which the patients are invited and the physicians, their physicians, are invited as well. And unfortunately, they sit, patients, physicians. And magic happened, the first one. This guy who had paid his own way from Rome to come and do this meeting in Arizona, stood there, was talking about essential thrombocythemia, and said, well, you know, one of the consequences is that with splenomegaly, you get cachexia. And I looked at the patient group who were all going, hey? And so when I got up, it was my turn next. And I said, before we go on, splenomegaly, big spleen. Big spleen means you can't eat as much. You get less protein. Less protein is called cachexia. You get weight loss. And the patients all went, sense. And the docs were kind of like, yes, yeah, so what? Because, of course, they know the lingo. They know the language of medicalese. Well, in the process of this, it meets every other year. One other time I got there and somebody asked me a question. So this was a throwaway. And he said he didn't understand. Sometimes he gets hematocrits of, this was a polycythemia, of 50. And a week later, they want to repeat and it's 45. And a week later after that, it's 52. It's bouncing all over the place. And I, so stupid here, said, well, what time of the day do you have your specimens taken? You should probably try having your specimens collected at pretty much the exact same time that it was on the day of your diagnosis, so that the pre-analyticals, didn't say that word, are consistent because they vary. Patients went, oh, okay, that makes sense. A physician gets up and says, you got to be me. It's a quote. I never knew that the hematocrit varied during the day. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the single most important value if you've got polycythemia vera?
That packed cell volume.
Yep. No. And then that was that also led me into an RDW. You have an RDW over 22. Could you please stop using the hematocrit because it's wrong? And again, from all of them, it was, well, why? Because this is what the RDW means. It's not just a number. It has a meaning to it. And if you translate that with the hemoglobin, You're not going to get a valid answer. But what you in particular as hematologists need, you need to then go by the hemoglobin. Mm-hmm. And there was this, And of course, going back to one of the other ones, somebody else said, well, I don't understand. Some days I get to have my cytoreductive therapy and my white cells are too low. And I've driven, 3 hours to get here and I'm exhausted and la, la, la. Is there anything I can do? I said, run up the stairs. What? I said, run up the stairs. Do some exercise or adrenaline inducing something, because your cells are going to drop off from the marginating pools and we'll count them. And again, from the docs, I was getting marginating pool. Mm. What's that? I had to explain inflammation 1 year. And I got the same reactions from both sides of the room. I never understood it. Mm. Well, if you never understood it, there's two separate, or it's like having polka dots. Mm. That's your values, but there's no way to connect those dots mm-hmm. together. And whose fault is that? Yes. No. Yes. Am I saying that they should add 6 more years to medical school? No. But when third year students come to your hospital, it is your responsibility, not theirs, to give them the information that they need, because they don't know that they need it.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like, I might be ostracized for this, but generally speaking, I think there's an attitude that pervades the laboratory that, us and them, sort of. Like sometimes there's this us and them, the clinical, the care staff, nurses, docs, PAs. But we don't do a good enough job to take ownership of this education piece, right? We'll talk about to each other how ridiculous this lab order is. And
think about the last 3 years. How many of you heard ludicrous requests on the phone that included swearing and I don't know, threats to bodily harm and all that kinds of stuff that has increased your stress level enormously?
Yeah.
Okay. Usually in a relationship, when that happens, there is a response. Now, I am not suggesting poking in the nose the first physician that you find, or slapping any nurse that walks in the door. Mm-hmm. But I am saying rounds.
Yeah.
Go on rounds. Talk to people during rounds. I don't know where to put myself. It so frustrates me that laboratory people think they're stupid. And laboratory people think that they don't count. And that it was a joke before, but it was meaningful, that you go down to a corridor and there's a huge door that says danger, authorized admittance only, don't touch this door or you will die. And you open it and you get into the laboratory. And luckily, hematology is usually the first door. So they get to you before they get to anything else, because further down is chemistry and that's got machinery. And so nobody likes that. And further down behind another locked door is micro. So you're the one that they talk to. You're the one that as a laboratory will be the place somehow they're not afraid of. Mm-hmm. So use that. Every time you get a new class of PAs, anytime you got them for 2 years in medical school. Why don't you give them information over those 2 years? You can do it. Mm-hmm. 20 some years ago. In one sense, there's a titch arrogance to this story. 7 of us got together one day in a hotel room at an ASCLS conference. And I told them what I was doing with the AMLs and the CLLs and all these other people. And they said, we should do that ourselves. I said, of course we can. The 7 of us can do it. There were 6 hematologists and 1 urine slash coag person. You can do it. So without asking permission, we just set up part of a website on the ASCLS website and said, anybody who wants to ask questions of laboratory science concerns, ask them here. A year later, AACC said, oh, damn, we don't want you to do that sort of kind of alone. So they set up lab tests online. That entire time, when any human submitted a question, it came to us. Us was no longer seven people because the questions went from one a day, easy, to a little over 200 a day. So, I had to ask the chemists and then the micro people and a whole lot of other people from heme. I have a group of over 40 people. Mm. Well, they come and go, so it's a variation. We've been answering these questions since 1999. Mm. And they're sometimes they're just so emotional. My son is 6 years old, and these are his answers. My daughter has juvenile chronic myelogenous leukemia, and this, and this has happened. What should I do? We have figured out that part of the reason that you sit behind those doors that say closed, no admittance, authorized person only, you know, danger, danger, radiation, is because you don't have, as a group, we don't have the callus that surgeons have, mm-hmm. the callus that that nurses have, you know, to allow them to take a scalpel and put it into a human being or to do whatever it is that you're doing to people while they need care. You need to be able to somehow separate yourself, have that callus between you. And I would bet you that everybody who's listening here will not admit publicly that they have held the hand of somebody who they were phlebotomizing. After that was taken, the woman said this or the man said this, and you sat there and cried with them because you don't have that callus. You just don't. But on email, you can cry your heart out and then answer the question. Which is what we do. Sometimes you want to scream because physicians should have explained this because it's an almost outrageous kind of question. I'm trying to think of some of them. There was recently I get so nervous when I go to the doctor's office that the nurse always tells me I have high blood pressure. And when I go to have blood tests taken, I'm so nervous that occasionally I faint. Is that going to do anything to my blood test result?
Just this.
You know.
Yeah.
You have to sit back for a minute before you just type those answers in. Mm-hmm. There are the chemistry people do a lot of the chemistry, thank goodness. So you don't have to worry about, I tested positive for amphetamines and I never take them. What does that mean? The answer, by the way, is it depends on the methods. Because there are some things that we eat and some things that are other medications that will turn up positive depending on the screening. I have actually learned how to understand thyroid testing because over the years, you know, my TSH is 14.2. Is that high? And does that mean I'm hyperthyroid? Okay. Look to the right of your results and you will see a set of values. Those are called reference ranges. Or sometimes I use ranges of acceptability. So I don't want to get into the lingo. Mm. Yours is higher than that. Meaning, la, 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 la. It's very much it's very much freshman English that we're doing. No, I tend not to use the word epinephrine. If they've already used adrenaline, we'll just stick with adrenaline because it makes sense. My personal favorite, this guy wrote and said, I'm wondering if there's trouble here. About 6 months ago, I really felt funny and my heart was beating fast. I went to the emergency room and I got a CBC and they told me I should see my doctor. My white count was 89.4 and they were 80% lymphs. And the physician in question said, oh, not to worry, it's probably a viral disease. I will now wait while you all beat the table in front of you in, you know, like frustration. He said, so, about 6 months later, after that, he went again to the emergency room for cardiac palpitations. He was now at 125 with, you know, a coincident lymphocyte count. And he was nervous about that. So before he saw the physician in question, he asked his next door neighbor, who was an oncologist. So what do you think? And he said, you look healthy. It's probably a viral infection. So you can't say, I don't care what you think. You cannot type, this is chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Get yourself to someone who actually knows what they're doing.
That's tough, right?
Unfair kind of thing. But you can say, look, you're obviously insecure about this. Why don't you go to a hematologist? Mm-hmm. The person who specializes in blah, 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 and have them look at this and see what's going on. Because it could be almost anything. Who knows?
Yeah.
And by then he was writing back and forth to me. And so he went to a hematologist. And then he wrote back and said, they think I have CLL.
Me too.
Oh, yeah, me too. No, you say, oh, okay, that would make sense. Mm-hmm. Because da-da-da-da-da.
Okay.
So it's very kind of supportive in that sense. And somewhere in there were, are there more tests to do? Oh, yes. These are the following tests that might be ordered. Some of them might not. And you go through the whole thing as to what might be ordered and what might be the answers for it. And the real, he wrote back a few weeks later and said, yeah, it's CLL. Like, oh, really? Piece of cake. His major comment then was he was working. This was a man in Las Vegas and he was working in one of the shows. And his big issue was, am I going to lose my hair? Am I going to look sick because I can't afford to? You know, so you could kind of get them through that, you know, and move them along. But yeah, they can be that. They can be, my INR is 4.6. Does that mean I need to take more warfarin or less? Not a surprise. By now, everyone will understand. I have a very long answer.
Yeah,
that's just a cut and paste.
Yep.
And it talks about coagulation. I mean, it talks about the fact that there are 15 different, if you count the kallikreins and stuff, there are 15 different compounds that are involved in this. And in this particular instance, this drug interferes with this. And this is, it's in English. They understand it. People are not stupid. When I was in the hospital, they had me on warfarin. And they would come in for an INR. And some numbnut would come in a little while later and say, well, your INR is high. And you're going to bleed because your blood is thin. Now, again, you two know that there are certain phrases that are an allergic reaction to me, and thick and thin blood.
That's carried over. I hope you're proud.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
We're both severely allergic to thin. Yeah.
Yes.
Well. So, yeah. So I said, no, it's not. You know, I'm in ICU. This is like 2 days after they've pulled an intubation tube out. I can barely speak. And I said, no, it's not.
I'm not surprised.
The only thing that causes thick or thin blood, because it's a viscosity thing, is cytoreductive therapy. This is an anticoagulation. And I had one nurse practitioner laugh at me and say, you don't really think people are smart enough to understand that, do you? And I said, I've been answering that question for, well, kind of like all my life. And the answer is yes. If you treat people with the respect that they graduated from high school, you know, and understand even limited English, they can understand anticoagulation, then they can understand warfarin and how it works. And all of these people who use their blood thinners and all of that stuff are just, now the Eliquis is probably not going to be happy with that, but anybody who uses blood thinners should be strung up on a cross, as far as I'm concerned, because not only do they clearly not understand the medication they are causing someone to use, they also don't respect their patients.
Yeah.
And they,
what do you think that comes from? So, like, do you think
medical school? Medical school tells you it doesn't matter. You have to be sure. You have to project to your patient surety in all things. So in any sense of questioning, they're going to tell you, well, it's that. And it's going to be immediate and it's going to be sure. And blood thinner is something they understand as a medicalese shortcut to patients. And so they don't understand the process because they've never looked at coag that way. They don't understand what the action of the drug really is, because a lot of places you go in with a four. Now, for those of you who aren't statistically oriented, when you graph amount of warfarin to its action, it goes up like this, and then it's somewhere around 4, 4.2, it levels off. So whether the answer is 6 or 4, it's a technicality in many ways. The person's at high risk for bleeding. Okay. People will have written saying, I'm really afraid my grandmother in another state is on blood thinners, and her INR was 3.9. And they said they were going to have to give her infusions of vitamin K at 3.9, you know? And then it turned out that she got blood clots and, you know, there's this whole story that evolves. And you look at it and say, somebody doesn't understand the lab. And who in the lab is responsible for that? Because we have to be responsible for something. You know, if I have said once, I have said 6 million times, have a salad every freaking day. because as long as you're consistent,
consistency,
again, pre-analytical issue, as long as you're consistent, the medication will be consistent. But no, don't have no salad for 4 days and then have a big Caesar salad for lunch. That's just painful to even think of. But if you explain to them the relationship between vitamin K, a 3-day reserve, you know, so things are going to take time. Most of them all go back and say, oh, you know, like I never knew that. And then I have to admit that this is the bad part about this. People will write back on both sides of the aisle, on the CLL list and on the MPN list and stuff, and the stuff from the CI, from the ASCLS Consumer Information Response Team, they will write back and say, I photocopied your answer and took it to my doctor. And I will tell you, we have had close to 1 million questions on the ASCLS list. And I don't know how many I've answered over the years for other people. Not once, ever, ever, ever has a physician written back saying we have overstepped our lines, that we are incorrect, that we're practicing medicine, nothing of that sort. They recognize you have value even though you don't.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I really don't. Except, of course, it's me. And as I say, I've never shut up once. Why don't we all do it? Do you not value yourself? Do you not have enough self-worth to go out there? I mean, I had one idiot one day. This is the simple one. It'll be the last one. Actually, I should take that back. I had a first-year resident. Came into the lab at 10 past 4. You know, cleaning up. Going home soon. This is good. It came in and had a lavender tube in his hand and said, if I pop the top of this and I pour out most of the liquid that's in there, and I put in some blood, can you do a sed rate? Now, I said earlier, and any of my students know, sed rates are also an allergic phenomenon to me. So I said, on whom? Well, yeah, I have this 3-month-old that was just admitted to PEDS. Does he have rheumatoid arthritis? Well, of course not. He's 3 months old. Neonatal sepsis? Of course not. He's 3 months old. Does he have cancer? Mm. Now he's getting annoyed. Now, is he pregnant? Well, I don't know. Because I'm like, those are the four. Said, I tell you what, I'll make you a deal. You go upstairs and actually do a physical and a history on this kid. And if I'm going to guess that inflammatory issues might be the only one of those four that makes sense to you. If you find any inflammatory issue, you call me. I will wait. I will go upstairs. I will collect the specimen, and I will stay, not overtime, not getting paid, to do this. So he left. And I waited, and nothing happened, and I went home. Mm-hmm. The next day, I came back to work, obviously, and the chief of pediatrics, who at this hospital is, I think, internationally known, hematology pediatrician, so we got a double whammy there, came down and said, who spoke to? Can I buy you a cup of coffee? because he was very annoyed at the first year resident for what had happened. And he wanted to explain to this guy how wrong he was, but he also wanted to thank me. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, sure, fine. Break is soon. You know, I'm not gonna say no to a cup of coffee in that sense. I turned around and saw 12 other people in the lab going, because I don't know why. They all knew. What are the four reasons that you do sed rates at all? Mm. They all could have said every single word I said. Mm-hmm. But they were intimidated. And the physician chief was grateful. Mm. Why don't we do more of it?
Mm. It's a great question to ask. And my intuitions are that the general makeup of the individuals that become laboratorians are these meek and mild, and it's unfortunate because all of them worked really, really hard to get their degrees and pass their relevant certifications and things like that. And I think you've touched a point where I think intrinsically some of us don't think we have value, you know, and it's ridiculous. And these clinical teams want our input, you know, they,
by and large. Organics, for God's sake.
Yeah.
No, that's clinical chemistry. And apparently, although I never quite figured this out, no one ever passed my hematology courses, but you all graduated and you all got certified. So I don't actually understand how that happened, but you all of you across the country, this is not an easy major.
Yeah, right.
In many places, it's regarded as the most difficult major, and you graduated. You can stand toe to toe with anybody. So, you chemists out there, are you talking to the Diabetes Association during National Diabetes Week to talk about the differences in blood testing and how to do it correctly? Those of you who are near or have an active heart association, are you going out there to talk about lipid testing? Do you really have to fast for 14 hours? Or is that no longer real? What's going on in testing? What in heaven's name are some of these new things that people are talking about? Because somebody who's been a cardiac patient for, let's say, 20 years, remembers when LDL was the only thing, and now there's VLDL and there's all this other, and they sit there going, what? You know, how is this real? Are you out there talking to them? You know, certainly the hematology people, ever heard of National Leukemia and Lymphoma Week, Month, Year? You know, why aren't you out there talking to your local sickle cell group? My son has sickle cell and he only needs to get blood products every 4 or 5 months, but she has a kid who's got sickle cell same age, and they have to have them every other week. Why? What's another abnormal hemoglobin? You know, because somebody's talking about a mixture of sickle cell and something else. Are you there talking about it? Because each one of you had to pass an exam that had those. No, each and every one of you. How many of you were out talking to parent groups, elderly groups, Council on Aging, political people? Mm-hmm. What the hell? What is COVID? Mm-hmm. What does that mean when people say, oh, somebody had COVID? Mm-hmm. What's the process? You all know the physiology. Why should you have vaccines? There's another request by CDC that says that elderly people over 65 who have serious conditions, open heart surgery, should go and have another booster. How many of you know grandparents who fall into that category, or they have diabetes, or they're overweight, or they have asthma, or they have COPD? You talking to them? You know, are you saying, grandma, you got to go? Oh, yeah, it's a pain. Yeah, I'll take you there. You got to go. Are you doing that? Are you doing that with your neighbors? Are you doing that with, as I say, Council on Aging? Mm-hmm. National Heart Month? You can do this. No, I'm going to change that. Last words, I promise. You must do this, or people are going to die, or they will be seriously compromised, maybe for the rest of their lives.
This is a wonderful topic to explore, and I think it does kind of excuse me, my phone. It does kind of fall to I feel empowered after this conversation, right? Like, I think, and I hope that we did a good combination of ruffling feathers and kind of maybe waking people up a little bit.
I would be glad to. I obviously don't have them in my hand, but I could just pull off a day's worth of questions and come back and just, these are the questions we got today.
Yeah.
How do I take care for my son When he's sleeping so that I can test him for drugs is one we don't answer very often, but
yeah. Yeah. But
really, it sounds like, you know, for patient advocacy, the biggest thing that we can do is talk to everyone. Just talk to physicians, educate them, talk to patients, and make sure they're educated. And we, even as, you know, a person coming out of school, we have the educational background to do that. And I think that folks just need to know that.
Yeah. I don't know how many times now over the years I have walked into an outpatient area to have blood tests, lipid functions done. And I would say I have been asked if I have fasted, I don't know, maybe 15 times in 10 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So you've already ruined your pre-analytical issues here.
Yep.
We own pre-analysis. Talk to your patients. Did you do this? How many bananas have you had lately, or whatever it is you can't have for one of the chemistry tests?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because trust me, the physician will say, I want you to have some blood tests. And you go to the exit window to say goodbye, and they say, and they hand you a piece of paper that looks like this, which says, I should do something before the next time I see him. This happens to be a complete metabolic panel. Nowhere in there does it say that I have to be fasting.
It's crazy.
For 1 hour, 2 hours, 6 minutes, nothing.
Yep. Yep.
I always wanted ASCLS to make and sell for really, really cheap post-it notes called lab prep, complete metabolic panel. And so that the secretary could just peel that off, slap it on there and let it go. Yep. You know, again, I think it would save people from getting sick or dying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, misinterpretations, right, of the data, obviously. Yeah.
No, oh my God, you have 150 glucose. You're a diabetic. Well, actually, I just finished lunch.
Yeah.
Stopped in after lunch, about an hour ago. Oh, really?
This is a very important conversation. Yeah, I hope that people take away from this that feeling of empowerment. I hope that they feel a little bit better about being a lab person, right? Mm-hmm. And then most of all, we hope that they talk to somebody.
Yeah. Right? And it will be excruciatingly hard the first time you do it. So try it with your grandmother.
This is wonderful.
She loves you no matter what.
Well, no? Dr. LeClaire, thank you so much. This was a really great conversation. And
infinitely grateful.
Yeah.
Anytime.
So for our viewers that enjoyed this content, please subscribe to whatever the relevant platform is. Find us on social media, reach out to us via email, questions, comments. We love to hear from you, really do. And we really, really appreciate you watching. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening. Yeah, thank you. And everybody else, thanks for listening.
Thanks for your time.